body power. As much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
Welcome along to Tuesday Night's Football Show. It's Richie McCormack here at the helm. On the way, we will be talking about Mick McCarthy's latest 39-man Ireland squad ahead of the crucial qualifier with Denmark at the Aviva Stadium, and also that slightly less crucial friendly with New Zealand. That's to come. Kevin Kilbane will be taking a break from his ice dancing practice to join us on the line a little bit later on in the hour. And very shortly indeed as well, Gary Breen will join us to talk about the latest rumblings from North London on both sides of that divide and what was a pretty unpleasant weekend for both Arsenal and Tottenham supporters, and indeed for the captain of one of those particular sides. Last 16 action in the Carabao Cup as well, just past the hour mark in pretty much all of tonight's ties. At the Pirelli Stadium, it's now Burton 1, Leicester 2. Leicester had gone into a 2-0 lead, courtesy of goals in the first half from Kelechi Iheanacho and Youri Tielemans. Liam Boyce has pulled one back for the home side to make things interesting into the last half hour. Elsewhere in that battle of previous giant killers, it's currently Crawley Town 1, Colchester United 2, and frankly, both goals from the perspective of the Crawley Town goalkeeper Lion Bala will be not ones he'll want to view back anytime soon. Colchester helped by some dreadful goalkeeping tonight, and they lead into the second half of that particular tie. Elsewhere, it's Everton 0, Watford 0, a game which by all accounts is dreadful. And Manchester City are 3-0 up at home to Southampton at the Etihad. Goals from Nicolas Otamendi and Sergio Aguero on the double for City. That's Sergio Aguero second, coming on 56 minutes. Meanwhile, it's Oxford 1, Sunderland 0 into the second half of that one. It's Robert Hull who has gotten that goal for Oxford tonight. I'll keep you updated on all of those as the evening rumbles on. And we get closer to knowing the quarterfinalists are in the Carabao Cup. I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line by former Republic of Ireland defender Gary Breen on what was a fairly tumultuous weekend for North London sides. Gary, we'll start with Arsenal, a club I know they're close to your heart. Have you ever seen anything like what we saw, firstly directed at Granit Xhaka and then the reaction from the Swiss midfielder to the...
I think, Richie, it's been commonplace. He splits the opinion, Xhaka, there's no doubt about, in terms of his performances. But I've never seen something as really hostile as what we saw there. And obviously, it was a culmination of a few things. The very fact that the Arsenal team are struggling, they're not convinced about the manager, Emery. And then in that moment where Arsenal thrown away a two-goal lead, which they've done already this season and seem to do quite regularly, the urgency with which the supporters wanted to really attack the game in that last 20 minutes meant that Xhaka had to run off the pitch and get whatever tactics Emery wanted to get in place. But the very fact that he ambled off and slowly walked just drew the real anger from the crowd. And then to cup his ear in a way he's done, I think it's a difficult one. I think it's be a long way back on in terms of this, because I know in terms of Emery and such, and certainly in mainland Europe, the captain's role is not that big, but it certainly is within our game, the Premier League, and it certainly is a big deal at a club like Arsenal. I think there's only been 43 captains in 100 years, so it's something that's really marked out as something of a real honour, and you've got to wear it with distinction, and certainly his behaviour was neither of those things.
Yeah, it's something that Emery drew out in terms of his appointment of a captain when he came to the club, and it's something that it was drawn out from the point of view, as you mentioned there, that it's not necessarily as big a deal on the continent as it would be in England. But Xhaka, from all views of this thing, just seemed to be a really poor appointment.
Well, it was. And ultimately, Richard, this is the problem, is that if you've got to name five captains, essentially it means you haven't got one.
Yeah.
Because you can talk about all the top teams who have won things, and I know that you'll have someone wearing the armband, but you'll have so many leaders around that. And certainly Arsenal have had that. And you look at Chelsea, you know, John Terry was the captain, but it was so many other leaders, Drogba, Lampard, those type of guys, check. But they have to name a five-man captain's committee of something. It is a nonsense, really. And coupled with the fact that you allow the players to choose this. Now, I have a belief for this, and I don't veer away from it. If you go to any change room in football, regardless of who wears the armband, that change room will be able to tell you who's the leader, who's the problem solver, who's the decision maker when the games happen. But still, having said that, just because he's a popular person in a change room, being popular doesn't mean you're a leader. And this is the problem that they have, is that Xhaka is a talented player. Yes, he is. but he's probably synonymous with just where Arsenal are right now, in that he can do so many things well, but he can do so many other things that he doesn't even do it to a mid-table Premier League team, let alone one that's supposed to be challenging for a title.
Yeah, it's a weird one because he almost seems emblematic of the last couple of years of Wenger's reign there, which in and of itself was fraught with its own problems. But to have somebody who, like I say, was so emblematic of that era be suddenly your leader under what is, you know, essentially a new regime, just it's a dichotomy that doesn't seem to sit well at all.
Well, no, in terms of when it was made public that the changing room were going to decide who was the captain, the last one I thought would be Xhaka as such. And also you've got to be a little bit pragmatic at times and say, well, look, hold on, we need a positive appointment here, one that the fans really want, because they're very divided over him. And I think the majority now will be against Xhaka now because of that reaction.
Yeah.
But certainly you want to sometimes just pick someone who the fans like, even if it's an Aubameyang, regardless of the fact that he's a centre forward. Listen, Arsenal have had centre forwards as captains before, the likes of Van Persie, Henri. And I know they were top class players as such, but Aubameyang's in that category. So I was surprised that he didn't get it, because ultimately it's just a figurehead, really. It's not a decision maker. And ultimately, if you're looking for leaders, that leadership's got to come from the manager. And I think this is the problem that Xhaka's probably borne the brunt, is that there's a lot of frustration with Emery in terms of initially coming into the club, suggesting that he was going to change things, there was going to be more accountability, more discipline, more tactical awareness. And certainly in the beginning, he did that. I mean, he went on that 22-match unbeaten run, and you're thinking, yeah, it's good, but there were times that Arsenal were riding their luck. Then you see the collapse towards the end of the season when they should really have finished third, even though they were essentially the sixth best team. They had a real opportunity to finish third. They didn't. Then they get hammered in the Europa League. And then you just see those problems rearing their head again this season. The signings haven't convinced. There's a lot of frustration as well, centred around Xhaka, in the fact that he actually gets picked. Not that he's captain, but he actually gets picked ahead of the likes of Torreira, because Torreira was billed as one of the best young holding midfielders in football at the time, and certainly started well. And this is the frustration Arsenal fans have, is that Emery's lacking a little bit of consistency in terms of what he's trying to do, because now he's suggesting that Torreira is going to play in advanced midfield positions. This is a guy who scored 3 goals in 71 appearances for club and country. So, you know, he's not a goal threat. And this is the problems. And it was just one afternoon where it all come on top. And I just think it's going to be a difficult bridge now for Arsenal to repair, and certainly Xhaka.
On the criticism from the fans themselves, I realise that Xhaka's performances, like, I've seen him up close myself, he's not brilliant.
He's brilliant at certain things, Richie, in terms of looking after the ball. And people are saying that he's got a bit of bravery about getting on the ball. Well, he's getting on the ball and he's brave because that's what he's good at. He's not brave staying with runners, running off his shoulder. He's not brave in terms of his tackling. I mean, he's got 4 bookings in 9 games already. Look at his stats since he's been in the Premier League. His bookings, it's a nonsense. It really is. So he is just synonymous with where Arsenal are now. Now, this is the problem that he's probably going to face, is that everyone's judging him as an Arsenal captain by the likes of Tony Adams, by Vieira. But there's been 6 or 7 captains since those icons who have been nowhere near the level that you'd associate with Arsenal captains. So this is the problem that you have. Arsenal are operating at reduced status. They're not title challengers. They've got a real battle to even be in the top 4. And as a result, people might say, he's not good enough for Arsenal. Well, for a top 6 team, he probably is.
Well, on that, they're in a battle for the top 4. I think everybody can agree for that. They're top 6 sides. You know, I don't think there's much you're going to push them out of that top 6, barring a late run from somebody like Leicester, who could well hang on, actually, for the duration of the season. But given the battle that they're in, they're battling for the top 4, is there a lack of understanding from the fan base that are regulars at the Emirates to understand where Arsenal are and the level of criticism that they throw at the team? Like, because it seems like it's out of whack completely with other sides. It seems, I've read quotes in the last couple of days, that the atmosphere around there is more toxic towards its own team than perhaps any other top flight side in memory. It just seems a weird atmosphere there.
Yeah, it is, certainly at the Emirates. It really is, because I think people are so frustrated with the last decade under Wenger that there was an excitement that potentially Emery was going to come in and change it. And you could see the work. And I said it again, people becoming accountable for their performances. The likes of Özil were initially discarded because he wasn't training well enough. And he was someone who, under no matter how he performed, would always play under Wenger. But it just seems that this particular group of players, and this will be the concern for me, Richie, more than anything, is now we're starting to hear that the players are finding it difficult to understand what Emery wants. And when you start hearing that type of talk, you're starting to think this is the dressing room flexing its muscles a little bit. They're sensing that the manager's a little bit vulnerable, more so than he was when he initially came in. And they're probably trying to use that as a crutch now for their performances. But the bottom line is, and the Arsenal fans, they know it. They're an educated bunch. They know that this squad is lacking in terms of quality. It really is. Listen, there's some standout performers in that squad, likes of Aubameyang, as we said. But defensively, it's just nowhere near the levels that you would normally judge Arsenal. And this is not by mid-table standards. When you judge about an Arsenal defence, you're arguably talking about the best of the best, really, when you're talking about the iconic George Graham one that Wenger inherited, but then also the defence that he built with the likes of Sol Campbell and them type of guys. They're nowhere near that level.
This is what I can never understand about Arsenal, particularly in the way they did business in the summer, is that they clearly had a bit of money to spend, regardless of what was said at the start of the summer. The 80 million outlay on Nicolas Pepe shows that. But you're throwing Nicolas Pepe into a pretty top-heavy side anyway, when you consider that they can't really, more often than not, fit Lacazette and Aubameyang in the same side. So you throw Pepe in on top of that. Danny Ceballos, I suppose, is in that trio behind the main striker as well. They get him on loan. You get a loan sign and you take it. But that 80 million for Pepe, however he may turn out to be a player, it seems that money was better invested somewhere else, probably in defence, probably in centre defence, if we're being honest.
Yeah, but there's some context in terms of that 80 million, Richie. It's been deferred, isn't it? It's not an upfront payment. It's not a deal that many other clubs would have accepted for any other players.
But regardless of the fact that money was there.
Yeah, no, I understand the point. And add to that, 30 million spent on a young French defender who's gone back on loan to that club as well. His name evades me at the moment, sorry. But you're right. If you've got some money, and this is a frustration you've probably seen from the supporters, and certainly people who I grew up with, big Arsenal fans going week in, week out, is that they're saying there was a priority needed to strengthen that defence. You know, offensively going forward, they've got attributes. They've got, you know, the likes of those guys we said, and goals have never seemed to be a problem, but defensively just so vulnerable. And this is the frustration, is that it's not been money well spent. And as you quite rightly said, Ozil, one Premier League start, he's had one appearance this season, and you've got Pepe who's one goal in his 8 Premier League starts, and that was only a penalty. This is the frustration, is that people are thinking, well, we might as well go back to Ozil. Now, I'm ultimately a fan of Ozil's. I know why people don't enjoy watching him. But you build a team around players like that. Don't ask Ozil, who's got a left foot like a wand, to be running around crunching into tackles like Roy Keane or Vieira. Build a team around him. They just haven't been able to do that.
Do you build a team around Mesut Ozil now, or do you build a team around, are you thinking you build a team around the Mesut Ozil of 5, 6, 7 years ago?
Well, yeah, listen, this is the argument, isn't it? The people are probably saying that, but he's still got that quality, and it's up to the manager to try and get him in. But if he's made the decision, whether or not he's made the decision, or as we're led to believe now, the hierarchy are trying to put pressure on and trying to make life difficult for him, Arsenal, as if he will go so that they can get that £350,000 a week off their contracts. We just don't know. But I mean, I haven't seen him over the last couple of weeks. I've got a couple of games now for off the ball on some big games in December. And up to that point then, that'll be 18 months now that Emery's in charge. And I'll be able to see whether or not I think he's doing enough to warrant having that job, because there's no doubt he's coming under some intense scrutiny now.
That discussion seems to be circulating already, is whether or not he'll see Christmas.
Yeah, listen, I think the hierarchy will probably look at the situation, and if that toxic atmosphere at the Emirates continues, then that's when you see decision makers at clubs make a change as such. And you're probably looking out there and see what are the options. There's obviously that connection. We're seeing it in terms of iconic players coming back. Vieira is often the one that's often mentioned. But I just don't know. Listen, Emery, when he initially came in, I felt it was a good appointment by Arsenal, but I thought it was a great move for Emery also. But then I'm looking at scenarios that he had his struggles, even when he won the Europa League 3 years on the spin. Even his teams there were struggling away from home, went one season with no win away from home. And Arsenal seemed to be having those same problems. And there's still problems that were under Wenger, and I'm not sure if the upturn has been steep enough.
Is the a change in ownership, unlikely as it may seem at the moment, seems to be the one thing that actually could galvanise the support and bring about the change that I suppose the supporters want and the players and whatever management is there would need. But that seems like almost a fairy story at this stage, whether that's going to happen, whether Kroenke will find his way out.
Well, listen, in terms of the Arsenal supporters associations and various bodies of it, they try to flex their muscles and try to get rid of the chairman before Chip Kidd, but it didn't happen. Cronker just said, yeah, you voted him out, I'll put him straight back in. So they haven't got a voice. Arsenal fans think they have, but they haven't. And this is the frustration, is that they're using their voice now when they're in that stadium to voice their displeasure. And as a result, players who are not performing, and as a captain, you're always going to be vulnerable. You're always going to be the one that people go for first. So he should use more experience than that, Xhaka. But he is an emotional type of guy. We've seen it before. We've certainly seen it with the Switzerland team. We certainly see it in terms of how easy he is to disturb in Premier League games, with how often he gets booked through petulance. So it was just a bad afternoon for Arsenal. And I think it could get a lot worse when they go up to Anfield tomorrow.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you how you see that one going tomorrow night. I'd envisage a bunch of changes. We know Kevin Kelleher is going to start for Liverpool, which is a huge bonus for him and a great opportunity to have a look at the Cork goalkeeper. But you're envisaging another tough night for Arsenal up there tomorrow?
Yeah, I do, because of the strength in depth. Obviously, it's great to see our young players getting a game at one of the best teams in Europe, and hopefully he impresses. But I just look at the intensity with which Liverpool play, and it's the same old story. As soon as you make it difficult for Arsenal, they fold, and they have folded quite regularly at Anfield. You think of Emery and his tactics in terms of trying to play out from the back at Anfield, and Liverpool forcing 13 turnovers in Arsenal's defensive third. And you just think, you're just not learning your lessons. But listen, Arsenal have quality. It'd be interesting to know what team he picks. I know Xhaka hasn't travelled. I think that's a good decision, just to protect him, just to let it die down a little bit. But with every passing day that he doesn't come out and apologise or put some sort of statement out, I think it's just going to create a divide even further with the Arsenal fans.
Yeah, the nonsense that he's changed his social media profiles to be in Switzerland pictures and not Arsenal ones isn't going to help matters. Just to bring people up to date, Mason Holgate's given Everton the lead at home to Watford in the past couple of minutes, and Jack Stevens has pulled a goal back for Southampton away to Manchester City. City 3, Southampton 1 is the latest score from that Carabao Cup tie at the Etihad. I want to cross London, because Tottenham are also an interesting story at the moment. That loss to Liverpool, it looked like they wanted to, if they scored early, it was ideal on Sunday. And if they managed to hold on for at least a point, it was going to be great for them. It turned out that they didn't get anything from that game, and it only deepens, I guess, the sense of trouble, or, you know, Tottenham are in a bit of trouble themselves.
Yeah, listen, I've said this quite regularly. I felt that everyone suggested that Champions League final, brand new stadium, brilliant training ground, start of a new era. I always felt it was the end of one, to be perfectly honest, because this team is going to disband without a trophy. The very fact that Vertonghen, Alderweireld, Eriksen are now going to see their contracts out and leave a club where the likes of Daniel Levy, he assured everyone he was never going to be caught out in the way that he was when Sol Campbell left on a free for Arsenal. And yet you're effectively seeing £150 million worth of talent leaving the club. Now, initially, when they started the season, you think about this dark cloud that's over Tottenham. But so much of that has come about through Pochettino in terms of his sound bites. And I've always been a massive fan of him ever since he came into Southampton, because I've said to you guys before, I had some friends down there who were working under him and told me this is a top class manager, and I believe he is. But it just seems that he's developing that little bit of surliness, that sullenness in press conferences, and you're thinking, snap out of it, come on. The only thing I do understand, and I can see his frustration, why, is that he gets the Champions League final, he thinks now he can flex his muscle and entice some of the better players in Europe to come and bridge that gap so they can be title challengers. But he knows that no one wanted to come to Tottenham. They all want to go to Manchester United, even though they're struggling. They all want to go to other clubs. And this is the problem. The ceiling's been reached at Tottenham, and I think he knows it.
In terms of what they're able to offer wages-wise as well, I mean, it doesn't help. People can only look at the fact that Harry Kane possibly isn't earning what a Harry Kane-level player could be earning elsewhere. So a player potentially coming into Tottenham would look at that and think, well, if they're not going to give their best striker this amount of money, what hope have I got of getting that there? And I'll just take myself elsewhere.
Well, listen, Pochettino's looked at the situation now, and it's another rebuild. And he's probably looking at it and thinking, well, listen, look what I've done at Southampton in terms of how many players he developed into international players. The remarkable job that he's done at Tottenham. Now, he's at a stage now, and make no bones about it, he will know that people keep throwing it back. He's never won any silverware. And he'll know, does he really want to do a rebuild again at Tottenham? I'm not convinced he has the energy. I think he wants the challenge for titles. And I think he knows now it's not going to happen at Tottenham. This is the frustration. But in terms of what Daniel Levy has done, letting those three players go for nothing is the only real downside you can say, because ultimately he's assembled a young, vibrant team for a fraction of what they're worth. as you quite rightly said, in terms of wages. A highly sought-after manager, brilliant new stadium, brilliant training ground. He's done a fabulous job as the decision maker at that club.
The worst of both worlds, though, is that they've got players who are running down their contracts and possibly heading out the door, and not necessarily with their eyes firmly on the prize still at the club. And on the other side of that, you've got people like Dele Alli who do have long-term contracts there who aren't pulling their weight. He's come in for a lot of fire, specifically given his performance over the weekend, but Sunday was just the latest in a string of games for Dele Alli whereby he was anonymous. Now, there's people like Roy Keane to put it down to a lack of hunger, which is oversimplifying things to an insane degree, but that wouldn't be like Roy. Graham Souness is kind of going in for that kind of stuff as well. There is something lost with Dele Alli because there is a good player still in there somewhere, but the application seems to have fallen by the wayside.
There's certainly a good player there, and whether or not the application, I wouldn't be convinced about it. I would still like to give a little bit of context in that he's had a couple of injuries that he hasn't been able to shake off, and as a result, you don't do a proper pre-season. You're not at the levels that required, certainly not before Christmas anyway. It takes you a bit of time to build that up. That's so important, those pre-seasons. And don't forget that the season before, he's gone deep into the World Cup with England, started in that semi-final. I know there was about 9 or 10 of that Tottenham team who did with England and Belgium, whatever. But it just seems like he's caught up with him. And he's the upward curve in terms of his career was incredible. I was coaching at Peterborough when we were playing against MK Dons, and he was a standout player there. But even so, you probably couldn't have envisaged the quality that he showed at Tottenham initially. And he's one of the real standout successes of Pochettino's manager. But there's just a bit of a levelling off now, and it's about his determination and stuff to get back. But I agree with you. I think it's too easy just to say it's about desire and stuff like that. I just don't buy into that type of basic punditry. No, I think he's had a problem. He's taken a bit of time to get back. He's in a team that's struggling, at a club that's struggling. So they're not hitting the heights as before. But if you're asking me, will he? I think he can, certainly.
Finally, on a London tip, I want to talk about Christian Pulisic and his performance at the weekend because it seems like he finally came good. I mean, getting the perfect hat-trick is kind of what we all dream of. Header, left foot, right foot. It seems like, I spoke about this the weekend, it now seems like it could be a Fabinho at Liverpool kind of masterstroke whereby you ease him into proceedings and let him get on with things from there. But it seems like a good decision for Frank to hold off a bit and hold his powder a little bit.
Yeah, but he started the season so well, Richie. Initially, he played really well in that Super Cup against Liverpool. I remember seeing him covering it for you guys, Leicester, at home. And he was brilliant that afternoon as well. So he got the nod ahead of a few of the players. Then suddenly came out. And I don't know whether or not that was Frank just saying that maybe this was the suggestion in terms of what you would read the comments. Training wasn't quite at the level we required. It wasn't a case. And Frank Lampard doesn't allow these young players now to just try and turn up on a Saturday. They've got to be doing it every day in training. So that was a little reminder for a player who's had so much success at such a young age. Obviously, the captain of America at such an age. Obviously, starring in Europe as well. But it's brilliant. More than anything, it's about his character that he's been able to say, OK, listen, I'll show you. Gets his opportunity and takes it. And this is what you have to say with so many of those players at Chelsea. It's been so impressive in terms of what Frank Lampard has done. And probably puts more pressure on the likes of what's happening at Arsenal, certainly what's happening at Tottenham, and certainly what's happening at Manchester United on Solskjaer, in the fact that Lampard is doing such an obviously good job and that these young players have been given their opportunity and they're taking it. And now you've got a Chelsea fans who've never seen nothing like this before, to be perfectly honest. They've been challenging at the top, of course they are, but they used to buy any ready-made stars. And now they've got players who have come through the system and we keep seeing it, one of our own, you know, those type of songs that they keep on saying. But they must be so proud of their team right now because it's not just one way of winning. And initially, Pulisic was deemed as a replacement for Hazard. But if you think about last season, if Hazard didn't play well, Chelsea struggled, couldn't break teams down. Now it seems that Chelsea can beat you in a host of different ways, in a host of different systems and with different players as well. You have to say, I know it's early on and I know like it's a bit of a love fest for Frank Lampard at the moment down there, but he's done a brilliant job.
This was the period where we expected him to struggle, though, to be fair. And we spoke a lot at the start of the season about periods of grace and the fact that he'd be given, you know, a bit of time and a bit of leeway and a bit of elbow room that the pressure won't necessarily be on. But he's, you know, exceeding expectations. When you consider he's vaulted the likes of Mason Mount and Tomori into international football almost in the blink of an eye. I mean, that speaks volumes about what he's done there.
It does. But do you know what people don't really say and don't highlight enough is that these young players are exceptional players. They really are, and they're winners. Now, people will say, are you going to Chelsea's first team? They've had to deal with the pressures of playing in Chelsea's youth team. Now, you have to win, and they have been winning.
Yeah.
And for them now to come through to Chelsea now, they have a mentality about winning, what it means to play for Chelsea. Now, this is a club that, you know, you can win trophies, you can win the Champions League, and still, as a manager, you're not kept on as such. So these guys know what it's all about, but nevertheless, it's still a big ask. Now, the big test for them, knowing about the Premier League in terms of how demanding it is in the winter months, really, after Christmas, when they're starting to fatigue in terms of the actual backlog of games and how difficult it is. And also, the Premier League, more than any league in Europe or the world, is a quick learner. It works out what you're good at, what you're not so good at. So they'll start asking them questions that they haven't been answered before. But in terms of being given the opportunity, I've never felt, certainly listening to Frank Lampard and certainly seeing Chelsea play this season, I've never felt that he's just picking these young guys just to tick a box. I genuinely believe that he genuinely believes they're his best team.
Yeah,
and they're proving it. It's been really good to watch.
They're going to be a really interesting watch for the rest of the season as well. We had a text in from Paul in Cork. I just want to get your thoughts quickly on this as we double back to Arsenal, saying, Arsenal fan all my life. The current level of bullying that is meted out to the players that are being given digs on YouTube is now spilling over onto the terraces. It doesn't matter how much you pay for your ticket and how much the players are paid. Neither can justify the level of abuse these guys are facing from a bunch of know-nothing mugs, says Paul in Cork. The issue of specifically like YouTube channels, Manchester United have had that kind of grow, and that's festered a little bit of the ill feeling towards players and how that's, I suppose, manifested itself at Old Trafford. We see it as well at the Emirates. The whole Arsenal fan TV became this whole... it became its own thing and its own little...
negativity more than anything else.
But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, it just... people want to out-negative the other, and they want to be more entertaining in the way they do it.
Yeah.
And it feeds the way... It feeds the narrative of how the side is discussed. And it's not all that helpful for anyone, really.
No, but listen, it's a great point there in terms of what he's saying, in that you're right. There's a belief that you pay your money, you can say what you want. Now, we now know in terms of the racist connotations and stuff like that, that can never be acceptable in terms of paying your money and saying what you want. But there is a fine line. But ultimately, I will say this, is that when you're playing, as he's walking off the pitch, Xhaka, he's not hearing any personal attacks. All he's actually hearing from 60,000 fans or however many Arsenal were booing is the boo. That's all you can hear.
Yeah.
You can't hear any personal attacks as such. Now, let me tell you, I know that from experience. I tell you, when you're struggling when you're playing in the reserves, then you can hear every little detail of what that fan is saying about you then. But I do think it's a really big topic of debate in terms of how much should you accept. Now, we've been led to believe now that he's been trolled on social media in terms of threats made to his family. That can never be accepted. And nor should it. But I'm just thinking in terms of the whole anger and the volume with which it came off, is that they were chasing the winner. Get off the pitch. Mm-hmm. Don't make it about you, which he did essentially. And don't cup your ear to the fans. You're an experienced player. If you then, on another day, get the ball, which he's capable of, and bend it into the top corner from 30 yards, they'd be singing his name. It's just football. Now, having said that, you shouldn't take the levels of abuse that he was getting in terms of if he can hear it. But I just don't know. It's a great topic. I do believe that you go in, you pay, you can say what you want. And as a player, we've got to take it on the chin. If you're playing well, you take all the plaudits. If you're not playing well, you just got to get your head down and start playing well, and they'll change. The fans will be with you.
Yeah. Gary, pleasure as always.
Thanks, Richie.
Just to bring you up to date on what's going on in the Carabao Cup, last 16, couple of updates for you. As I say, Colchester now 3-1 up away to Crawley Town. Man City still leading Southampton by 3-1. And McNulty has equalised for Sunderland away to Oxford. Oxford 1, Sunderland 1 is the latest score. We will be back after this with Kevin Kilbath.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
James Maddison has scored a minute from time to put Leicester 3-1 up away to Burton Albion and into the last eight of the Carabao Cup for show. We're going to hear from Kevin Kilbane in a moment, but first, Mick McCarthy had his media hat on today, talking to the press following the naming of his latest 39-man squad. Our own Stephen Doyle was there and started by asking Mick about Seamus Coleman, specifically his competition on the right-hand side of defence for Everton with Jibril Sidibe.
In the long term, it just seems that Seamus Coleman now, he's kind of lost out to Sidibe at Everton. In the long term, is that a concern? Maybe, you know, he'll hopefully be looking to rely on next year?
Well, I watched their game on Saturday, and if he has lost out to Sidibe, he's got his work cut out to get in the team. Unfortunately for him, that might be like the questions I get asked about Matt Doherty. You know, why does Matt Doherty play at right back? Well, because Seamus Coleman's playing then, he's the captain and he's good. And I think that might be the question asked, because Sidibe is very, very good, having watched him on Saturday. So, yeah, fingers crossed we qualify, and if we do, then it would be a concern if he's not playing all season, of course.
Just after the Georgia game, Damien Duff on TV said that Aaron Connolly, when he looked at him playing against Tottenham, he said, this guy looks like he's ready for this level. But he did say he didn't feel Troy Parrott was. Would you disagree with that, or what's your kind of thinking about Troy Parrott?
Look, I'm not going to comment on what everybody says. Even Duffer, who's a great lad and a great player, it's not for me. They've all got opinions, but I'm not going to comment on everybody's opinion on what they are. And given the fact, up until now, I've never called him up, you might think I pretty much agree with him. But we've got a friendly against New Zealand, so do you not think it's an opportune time, if I really want to do, is to have a look at him and see whether he can play in that game.
Have you looked back at the Switzerland game since that nightmare?
Yes.
You did speak about the players not performing well and passing poorly, not being able to pass.
I said we didn't pass it to each other, yeah, that's what I said.
What was that doubt now that you've had a chance to...
Sorry, it was what?
What was that doubt now that you've had a chance to look back at the game?
Well, I think probably the fact that they were particularly good in the first half. You always have to give credit to the opposition as well. It's not always just about one team not playing as well as we can. And I thought when we settled down and we played much better in the second half, and it was a much better performance with the ball. So, I don't know. I don't put it down to anything other than that we were playing against a very good side who pressed us and closed us down.
There is a feeling maybe that some players feel that they will get picked no matter how they perform. Do you think maybe that some players should be worried for their positions in the team coming into the Denmark game?
Bearing in mind you seem to speak to everybody, who are the players who seem to think they're going to get picked and no matter how they perform?
Well, there will be a feel that there is players maybe that haven't been playing well in the last couple of games, that maybe they should feel that they're placed under threat, but maybe that you won't get good performance out of players if they don't feel that there's some other guy coming behind them.
Well, you know, I pick the team and I think on merit and where I think things should play and deserve to play. And I guess all the players who are not playing, and I'd have been one the same if, not that it happened too often, I'd always be thinking I should be playing. But that's for me to pick the side, isn't it? Not them.
That's Mick sparring with our own Stephen Doyle at the announcement of his 39-man squad for the upcoming friendly with New Zealand. And the make or break Euro 2020 qualifier with Denmark. Delighted to say I'm joined on the line by our own Kevin Kilbane, who has taken time out from his practicing on the ice to speak to us this evening. Kev, any injuries you want to update us on yourself?
No, I've still got that back injury, Rich. That's not really healed in any way. It's not improved in the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks probably now. So I still have a little bit of trouble with that. But yeah, that's the injuries you get. I've got a lot of hip injuries, elbow injuries, as you can imagine from the falls. It's
How frequent are the falls?
I'd say I've gone from having 9 or 10 a day to maybe 4 or 5 a day.
Jesus.
So I'm halving the time I'm spending on the floor, you know, on the ice, as they say. Yeah,
Ice is no crack to fall on either, to be honest.
No, cracked ice is even worse, Rich. Honest to God. But no, it's not. It does bloody hurt. I tell you. I said to you the week when I was probably first on, it would have been my back, Rich. Honest to God, it's so painful. The worst thing about, you know, I've suffered with back pain. This is a different sort of one. It's my upper back, yeah, in my rib cage. And every time I'm moving in bed, getting up in the morning as well, it's going back to the old days of when I was playing again.
Have you? Like,
yeah, it's not comfortable, Rich.
I wouldn't say so. Is it? Are you working with a partner yet? Are you working on your own? You're still getting to grips with the basics. Tell us where you are now.
No, we got to meet the pro skaters yesterday, the male and female skaters, but we're still in the dark on who our partners are going to be. I think we're going to find out in the next week. I'd say that's the way it's going to be. So my training has just been with a pro, with an ex-pro, and a professional coach. So he's just been training me or learning me, trying to teach me the basics, trying to go. And as you can imagine, I'm coming from a very low bar, Rich. So yeah. We're having to go up from that low bar and learn the little basics. So it's been good though. It's starting to take shape a little bit anyway.
Who's the threat that you're looking at now? Who's the one who's starting off with a higher bar than you are?
Richie, I'm in the bottom set, as I said before. I am right down to the very bottom. Everyone's coming from a higher bar than me. You'll have to watch the show, okay. Rich, to find out yourself, you know.
Very good. How's Maura?
She's in good form, yeah. Chatting to Maura yesterday. Yeah, she's in good form.
Yeah, good stuff.
Moira, Rich, come on, Moira.
Is it Moira?
Yeah.
Am I not pronouncing it right?
No, it's Moira. She's Irish, isn't she?
I know, I'd say Moira.
These
are my new shake, Kev. You're more Irish than me.
I know that.
I want to touch on something that Mick was talking about with Steve-O there. The issue of Seamus Coleman at Everton. Now, he started tonight against Watford and Everton. I've just gone 2-0 up through Richarlison. But it is a worry because McCarthy has always been a man who's based his picks in the international side based on who's actually playing Premier League football, namely. Seamus Coleman looked like somebody who was constantly assured of first-team football. Now, Djibril Sidibe has come along and made his place look slightly more uncertain at Everton.
Yeah, I do think even Mick, going back to when he was manager of me with the Irish setup, he did, I wouldn't necessarily say Mick special leeway, but he knew full well that if a player was playing well within the international setup, he wasn't necessarily going to change the team that dramatically. So, I think it is a worry. I think we all accept it is a worry going forward, but it's not necessarily a worrying position for us, is it? We've got a ready-made replacement. We know full well that Matt Doherty could quite easily fill in and play in that position. So if it was a different position, I think we'd all be a little bit more worried about it. I think Mick would be himself, but he is our captain. I think he's probably been our most consistent and best player over the last 6 or 7 years. So yeah, it is a worry. I think first and foremost, for Seamus there at Everton, he's got to maybe just get it out of his mind about maybe the international setup and get playing at Everton and get back in ahead of Sidibe. That's the thing that will be in his mind.
Well, he kind of has the ability to do that, given the fact that he's suspended for the Denmark game. It would appear unlikely that he'd play against New Zealand, given the fact that McCarthy might want to bed in whoever's
has he
playing
picked
it right
him,
back.
Has he picked him? I didn't see his name down today, so I don't know. Has he been picked? I wasn't sure of that. I don't think he's in the squad, so. That suggests to me that no, there's probably no point in playing him in the New Zealand game. Might as well just give one of the other lads a run out to see how they go with the view to that Denmark game anyway. So that's probably what it's all about for Mick as it is. We're not necessarily going to learn anything new about Seamus Coleman if you play in the game as it is. So I just said he's probably just going to concentrate on being back at Everton and trying to force his way back into that side. But I think he's equally as good as Sidibe anyway. Yeah. But Sidibe, because he's Marco Silva's man, he's always probably going to be ahead of him if the two of them are in a, if it's a flip of the coin. I think he would probably look at Sidibe ahead of him just because he would be Marco Silva's man.
Another point that Mick made there, I'm impressed by Steve-O, that he felt that Ireland were much better with the ball in the second half against Switzerland. Agree or disagree?
I think we looked more of a threat in the second half, didn't we? I wouldn't necessarily. I think probably over the two games, I don't think we were great with the ball over the two matches, the Georgia and the Switzerland game. But I probably would agree with him in terms of that. I think when we went, we started to move the ball a lot better with 10 men at times, because that was almost as if it was all else was lost here. One or two of the players in midfield thought or took it upon themselves to start to impose themselves on Switzerland. We had a couple of spells in the game, but it's a difficult one to say. I actually thought we probably looked a little bit more of a goal threat in that second half. The first half against Switzerland wasn't great. I don't think the two halves against Georgia were great at all, and that was the disappointing thing I think I took from those two games. Mick was right in terms of what he was saying, that the Switzerland game was never going to dictate the outcome of our group. But it did turn out that way. If we'd have, with the result that we got over in Georgia as it was, we could have won the game and qualified, and that would have been it. We didn't necessarily think that going into the two games, but I was just probably slightly thinking that the team were probably more of a threat. We looked more likely to score without necessarily having a lot of the ball and playing great football in getting the chances that we got in the second half.
The thing about it is that the one thing I got from watching that game up close was we seemed a bit confused, and ultimately the sending off for me had a lot to do with that, because you had to change your shape again once you lose a man. But we started off by playing three at the back. We altered that in the second half. We then had to alter it again with Seamus Coleman coming on. Speaking to Enda Stevens after the game, he said that they didn't practice all that much by playing three at the back in training leading into the Swiss game, which begs more questions. But again, I can't look at that midfield as it played against Georgia and against Switzerland. And I'm specifically looking at that three in the middle, anchored by Glenn Whelan, and then with Jeff Hendrick in front of him, and whether it's Heron or another. Like, that trio hasn't worked over the course of 180 minutes, and I can't for the life of me see it working again against Denmark.
Well, that's why. I mean, we spoke prior to the Switzerland game, sorry, and I felt it was a flip of the coin who he was going to leave out, whether it would be Jeff Hendrick or whether it would be Conor Harahan. Neither of them have played well. I don't think, you know, the goal that Harahan scored against Georgia at home at the Aviva, yes, it was a great goal. I think he played quite well in that game. I think Jeff Hendrick actually played well over the course of the first two games as well. But since that Georgia game, I don't think our midfield is working. And Glenn Whelan has been the best player. I think we're all accepting that. Glenn Whelan has been the best player in the middle of the park. Without being great, Glenn has done what Glenn would have always done. He's done his job. He's been disciplined. He's sat in front, and he's just used the ball efficiently without doing anything over elaborate, I think.
But we're almost down on Glenn with faint praise there, because yes, he has played okay, but he shouldn't necessarily be the best performer of that trio.
I wouldn't necessarily go along with that. I think he's got to. Glenn's the most experienced player in there, so you would expect him to take responsibility and start to try and use the ball the way that he would do it. Not necessarily raking passes all over the pitch, but I actually thought he did okay. I think he's done okay since Mick's come in. I know Glenn's faced, as I've always said, criticism that's been unnecessary. I think he's been a great servant for us, and he was always a pleasure to play alongside. But he was never the sort of player that would be too demanding of me when I was playing. Other midfielders that would have played alongside him would have been a bit more demanding. So that's where if Glenn, maybe at his age, he's probably a little bit more vocal without necessarily be demanding in terms of taking the ball. That's where you're expecting others around him to be a little bit more demanding. And it's the constant theme, not just under Mick Rayne. This has been over a number of years now, the lack of responsibility for taking the ball in the middle of the park. I felt as though that whenever we've taken the ball from a fullback in the middle of the pitch, I felt as though it's always gone back to that same fullback or stayed on that side of the pitch, whichever it's come from. I think there's been a real reluctance for the midfield players to turn out. And that is the immediate thing that's in my mind is a suggestion, is that's a lack of confidence and a lack of belief in themselves that they're going to take it. It's been no-risk football. It's been play it back to your fullback, perhaps even put the fullback or even a defender, a centre-half or even a goalkeeper, whoever it's been, a backwards or a sideways pass. And it's almost put them under pressure to lump that next ball forward, and then we try and push it on the second balls. But because we've been probably sat a little bit too deep in keeping the possession, we've not necessarily had players in position to win that second ball, so we've not been able to even play up in the opposition half. So that's the thing that I've noticed about it, not just in the last couple of games or last three or four games. That's been the case over the last couple of years. So I think there has to be a little bit more, well, not a little bit, a lot more responsibility in the middle of the park to take the ball and actually be prepared to pass forward and take a few risks with your passing. Not necessarily always have that willingness to go backwards, sideways, or put teammates under a little bit of pressure. I think there has to be a little bit of responsibility. Give me the ball. Yes, someone is up my backside. Someone is behind me. Someone is marking me. But I'm going to take that ball and I'm going to take it under pressure and relieve the pressure for the man on the ball. And I think that's been the real eye catcher, as I said, over the last few years, that reluctance to take the ball.
I want to talk a little bit about Ryan Manning, because his rise is again another product of the League of Ireland. He's come through Galway United, gone off to QPR. He's changed his position somewhat. He started off as a more advanced player, something of a winger, I guess, and he's been reverted into a left wing back at Loftus Road over the course of the last couple of months, and has impressed. It's an area that Mick had a lot of looks at when he considered the amount of players he's called up in left backs, the Greg Cunninghams, the Derek Williams, the, you know, whoever you want to go into this world. And
Ryan Harrow played there, didn't he? Of course, in a friendly as well.
And Ryan Manning's the latest one that he's looking at here. But he's fully deserving of his place given his performances for QPR this season.
Yeah, I think he's played every game this season at QPR. It's been a great story. I actually spoke to him prior to going over to QPR, and he was obviously going over with a lot of optimism, and he just never got a game. It looked like he'd be out the door at QPR. Then all of a sudden, Ian Holloway comes in. Just I remember the story, I think it was Ian Holloway said himself, he went to watch, I think it was an under-21 or under-23 game, saw him, he was a shining light in the game, thinks, right, I'll throw him in, and he started to have a bit of success. Then, after Holloway had left, he seemed to have a little bit of time in and out of the side. He went on loan to Rotherham. It looked like he'd be out the door again. And now, all of a sudden, Mark Warburton's come in and he fancies him. He's playing him in that left-back position. I've seen him playing in the 21s in a number 10 position. It's right what you say as well, Rich. He's played in a wider position as well, but he's more often than not been an attacking player, a creative player. But I think, as we're seeing now, if you are playing as a fullback, certainly the way that Warburton likes to play, and if you've seen his side, certainly the Brentford team that he's managed, the Forest, the Rangers side, it's very open and expansive football. It probably suits him being that attacking fullback, and he's having to play a lot more advanced. So it'll be interesting to see if he does get in, if he does make the final squad, if he does make the final cut, because it might be an opportunity for Mick to throw him in that New Zealand game, because he has spoken today about the likes of Parrott, the likes of Conley and one or two other youngsters that might be able to get more game time in the shirt, particularly Parrott. I know that he spoke off today that he might be able to get him in that game time. But Manning is one that I've looked at, particularly with the ability he's got, with the left foot that he's got as well. And we know Johnny Ward's been obviously on the show regularly enough, and he's sang his praises because he saw him playing when he was playing over in Galway, and he's seen what a player he can be. But it's been a lot. It seems like a long time for him to get to the position that he's in, but he's certainly in there on merit now, and I'd like to see him go and progress because he's certainly been a consistent performer this season.
Quickly, because it's interesting to note Mick's evolving thoughts on the likes of the Troy Parrotts, who started off by not being involved, and this would be too late to bring him in to, you know, he might get a game against New Zealand, and you never know, it could be an Aaron Connolly situation. If he plays well in whatever cameo he gets, he suddenly vaulted into the thinking for a place on the bench, at least against Denmark.
Yeah, I mean, you know where I stand on it, Rich. I mean, he's still not played, you know, take the Colchester game in the last round of the Carabao Cup, the AFL Cup. That's his only senior start in football. So there's a massive step up. And I know Mick referenced the four goals that he scored in the Champions League, was it the under-19 Champions League game against Red Star the other week. He's referenced that as well. But it's still going to be a huge step up for him. But it seems, and again, we will not be able to judge him. I don't think we'll be able to Jaron Connolly till he's played 25 games, seriously judge him and how his career will go. And I think that'll be acceptance from the people that's at Brighton as well. But certainly with Parrott, there has to be a reluctance to pick him because of his lack of senior football at any level. So Mick suggested today, as I was saying, it's a huge step up. But he seems like he's got the temperament. He seems like he's got the ability. But again, seemingly from playing junior football or underage football, it's chalk and cheese. But the New Zealand game is the ideal chance. It is. If Mick's going to have a look at anyone in that game. And you're forgetting, as I've constantly said in the past as well, Mick had to call up so many youngsters over the years, like Shea Given, like Ian Hart, like Gary Breen and players like this who were part of the under-21 setup. And you weren't necessarily considering them for the senior side, and all of a sudden he had to put them into the senior international setup, and the careers flourished. So Troy Parrott might be one of those players that actually, when they make that step up, the career starts to progress.
Kev, we'll let you go and rest that old man back of yours.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good top, Rich, as well. Looking well, pal.
Thanks very much, man. Yourself too.
The ads start now. Paddy Power sponsors the Off the Ball Football Show.